Hello and welcome to episode 110 of the Rollo and Slappy Show. Today is September 17th, 2018. I am Rollo McFlugel and with me is Slappy Jones too, and we are both of McFlugel.com. Show notes page for this episode is McFlugel.com/110. You'll find links to subscribe to this podcast and all the podcast catchers, as well as subscribe to our email newsletter, where if you sign up there, you will get a discount off at libertymugs.com. And make sure to go check that out, too. We sell libertarian-themed mugs. I hope you enjoyed last week's episode, because we actually did a little bit of a time warp when I realized after I published it, I said it was 2019. And so we hope you, because I, looking at my notes, I wrote it was 2019 there, so.
Why did you do that?
Because we actually, this podcast is actually a time machine, too. So yeah. It happened. So
we didn't do that yet.
No, we did. We went into the future and did it. And released it for everyone. So I don't know, maybe that should be our free market success story.
Sure.
That people that listened to this podcast got a free time travel ride, and they didn't even ask for it. We just gave it to them because we're good dudes. We're good libertarians who believe in giving away free stuff.
All right.
So, Slappy, why don't you introduce our episode topic?
Is this for our episode we're doing 6 months ago?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
All right. So today's topic we're going to talk about was inspired from Twitter exchange that Rollo had with our good friend Vake.
Yeah, it was actually a friendly Twitter exchange for once. Not with Vake. We always have friendly Twitter exchanges with him, but.
Yeah.
Just in general.
Yeah, just. Anyway, it was a good question, and it was a probably a little more than fits into however many characters Twitter allows. So we said we'd do a podcast episode on it. So the question is, what about fraud? Is it a violation of the non-aggression principle? There's no physical harm. How would the market solve that? And I think there's a lot to say about it. And Vake brought up some decent points, which I can't look at because my phone's not working, which is why I keep saying and trying to get it to work. So, Rollo, what are your thoughts on fraud? Is it a violation of the NAP?
Yes, it is. I would say so. But also, I don't think it matters if it is or not. We've talked about the non-aggression principle before here, and I wrote about it. Just that, not that it doesn't matter. The non-aggression principle matters a lot, but it's just a guideline. I don't believe it is an axiom, so I just kind of want to throw that out in front, kind of qualify with what I'm saying, because I think it strengthens kind of what we're going to talk about later with how to deal with it. Because even if you could make the case that it's not a violation of the non-aggression principle, it certainly isn't savory.
Desirable.
Right. Just like it's not desirable for Grum to be trying to chew on the wires again.
Desirable for who?
Yeah. Well, for me. Apparently, it's not just Bitcoin that he doesn't like. It's just he doesn't like we're in the triple digits, I think, for podcast episodes.
Yeah, maybe if you give him a little more attention.
Maybe. So, yeah, but
so wait. All right. So try again. I don't have Vake's tweets up, so I'm kind of handicapping myself. What was his case or question?
He kind of said, is it just is it a violation of the non-aggression principle if you're just kind of lying?
And like, is lying generally a violation?
No.
Like if I told you I'm at the Monday night football game right now, like that's not a violation of the NAP.
No, it's not. But it's not just fraud. Is not just lying. It involves kind of an exchange usually.
Like, well, fraud is, I mean, in some cases of fraud, certainly it would be like theft by deception.
Right. Well, that's what I would say it is.
Yeah. I mean, you're most representing typically. Something like I say, I'm going to sell you, my car, and my car has 20,000 miles on it. You can look at the odometer, but I spun back the odometer. It really has 60,000 miles. You exchange that money believing it was a car with $20,000. Obviously, you would not have, and we'll assume you would not have paid that amount of money had you known it actually had 60,000. Right. That's fraud. That's lying. That's theft. You stole the money. You purposely didn't give all the details or lied. Right? I mean, how deep do we have to go? I mean, if there's something I don't
know. Well, where do you draw the, to play devil's advocate, where do you draw the line on that? Is it, and, well, would it be fraud if, I don't know. I'm trying to think of something where.
If you didn't ask about the tires, so I didn't tell you about the tires? And as soon as you get this car, you're going to need to replace the tires. Is that fraud? I knew they were bad. I didn't tell you they were bad. You didn't ask if they were bad.
Yeah, that one you might need an arbiter.
Right.
Because that one's a little bit of a toss up. I mean, I don't know what. Because he did bring up the point where he said, isn't it up to the other person?
The buyer.
Right, the buyer to kind of check up on things. Right. And I mean, if you go out and buy, I think bringing up buying and selling a car is the perfect example because that's stereotypically, something that if you tell someone you're doing that, especially if you're not doing it at like a reputable dealer.
When you like the classic used car salesman guy.
Right. Or just finding someone on Craigslist or something. And how do you trust that? Because a car is a kind of a complex kind of thing.
Right. And there would certainly be an incentive if you have a bad car to try to get as much money out of it as you can. It's not going to work for you.
Right. So if you want to risk having someone be annoyed at you and think that you cheated them, I guess you could not tell them even if you know that the tires are going to be bad and it's, you know. That's several hundred dollars to replace tires, typically.
Oh, I know it.
Yeah. So, I mean, depending on the value of the car, I mean, if you're selling a car for, you know, your used car, something else is a very nice car and it's $40,000. I don't think, they're probably not $75 tires put on a car like that, but, you know, when it's a small fraction of the value, I think it matters a little bit less. Whereas if you're buying a car for $800 and then you got to spend another $200 that you weren't expecting, I think that might matter a little bit. But, part of it, I mean, that wouldn't, yeah. I don't know how that should be decided.
It's a really tough topic. It's not real cut and dry. I think.
Other than the fact that, and like Vake brought up, that you should be doing your own due diligence, and absolutely you should.
Well, we could talk about ways the market could help that.
Yes.
But we're just talking in a general.
Yeah, concept. We'll get deeper into that a little bit later on.
Because, if you're, like, I think it's really hard to determine a standard to say you have to disclose this much about whatever you're selling, otherwise it's fraud. I mean, there's some things, if I was selling my car, I don't know cars real well. For all I know, I could be selling you something with bad shocks and you buy it. So because of that, I want to sell my car for as much as possible. And this is kind of probably more market stuff, but I could show you my receipts of when I got it, things replaced and fixed, or I could have it inspected or have a mechanic look at it and sign off on it. And then he's putting his reputation behind it.
That's that's what I would do is if I would ask for you to bring it to my mechanic, a guy that I trust.
Right. And he could look at it and say, yeah, this is a great car. Go buy it.
Right.
Or you could say, you could buy it, but you're going to have to replace all this stuff in about 10,000 miles or whatever the case is.
Right. And that's why you might be more likely to go to a dealership, like a place of business where
they have a reputation to keep.
Right. And whereas a guy off the street, maybe he's a great guy. Maybe he's a jerk, but you don't know that. And that's part of the risk. And that's part of where the price system would work because you're probably going to get a cheaper price because
you're a great deal.
Right. Because you're when you go to a dealership or something or some place of reputation, you're paying a little bit more for security. So it depends on the person's risk tolerance. But to go back a little bit and say, well, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, all that being said, like, those are ways we could help minimize fraud. But I think the question is it a violation of the NAP? Yes or no? And maybe you already said this, and I kind of agree. It really doesn't matter because it's not desirable. So we would find ways to weed it out. Like you were talking about it being axiomatic. I mean, if someone did commit fraud, like, what could you do back to them?
You could ask for demand restitution. It would nullify the transaction. I mean, because that's what it is. I mean, it's when you make a transaction like that, it's a contract. It may not be explicit. You may not have a piece of paper that you sign.
Implicit contract means you agree to the social contract, correct?
Oh, man. Well, there goes everything.
Sorry.
We're not libertarians anymore now because of that. No, but yeah, it's an implied contract, and that's where is the deception intentional? I think that
there's
comes
a lot
in
that
a
would go
bit.
Into it. Yeah, right. I mean, I think even if it wasn't intentional, you could probably have a case to avoid a contract on things that you didn't know.
Right, and I think that's where an arbitration, that helps. But I think it's certainly one of those things where it's like, okay, what would a reasonable person expect? About the quality of something. For example, I think this speaks some volume, or at least it promotes the idea that reputations are important. If you go to the supermarket, your expectation is if you buy a carton of eggs, that those eggs are going to be fresh and, you know, that you're going to be able to use them and they're not going to be nasty. They're not going to be bad. They're not going to be rotten. If you go home, and you crack the eggs open and they're like rotted inside and they smell terrible. Well, I don't think anyone at the supermarket was probably trying to do that on purpose to say, hey, we can sell rotten eggs to people and still make money. But you go back and say, hey, these eggs are rotten, without question, they're going to give you your money back. Without question. Right. Right. One way or the other, they're going to make you whole. And it's because implicit in that, because you don't go into the supermarket and say, well, I agree that when I buy the stuff that I agree that, or we both agree that it's going to be of this certain quality. Even though on the carton, it probably has
Best Buy or, you know, Fresh Buy, whatever day.
Yeah. And it probably has some language on guaranteed. There. Yeah. We high quality. I mean, a lot of foods have, and products in general have stamps of some sort of quality thing. Yeah. But it's when you, after the transaction's over and you inspect when you finally can really inspect what you have, because you can't, I mean, you can, when I buy eggs, I open up the carton, make sure they're all whole. There's no cracks in them.
Same here.
But you can't sit there in the middle of the refrigerator section and start cracking eggs open to make sure they're fresh.
Checking them all, yeah.
So there's really no way to know for sure that you're getting what you bought until the purchase is over and you take it home and start using them. And if they're not of the quality that you would reasonably expect, you know, we don't necessarily have to say this is fraud. But it's a violation of the implied contract, really, technically. And so you would be...
went and paid for eggs that you could use. Right. So they're going to provide you eggs you can use.
Right. That's the expect. That's a extremely reasonable expectation. Unless you go there and there's a sign on the refrigerator door that says, hey, buy these eggs at their own risk.
Yeah, these eggs are past expiration date. Some are rotten. You can have them for a quarter.
Right. I mean, these are often the manager specials.
Yeah.
And you see that. Maybe just look at the expert.
Even there, they usually have, I mean, I don't know where you shop. Maybe they do put dairy products in there.
No, I've never seen it. It's more on things like meat.
Yep.
That have to be sold that day.
Yeah.
And there's an expiration date on it. I mean, and this is very important. This is why they go, you know, through leaps and bounds to make sure that they're supplying good stuff, because it's a supermarket. Quality, freshness, at a decent price, and good customer service. I mean, that's what these places have to survive on. I mean, I'm sure most of us have a certain supermarket or a couple supermarkets that we normally go to. If we got sold a bad product, it would probably be, you know, one time. It's okay. Mistakes happen. Not a big deal. If you started out 2-3 times in a row that you're having bad experiences, chances are you're not going back to that place. So there's a really good incentive on the seller's part to make sure that they're meeting the expectations of their customers. And it has to be reasonable. I mean, there's always there's a meme about it of the woman with the "I want to see your manager's" haircut. Yeah. You know, some people are just unreasonable, and they got to deal with those people too. But
when they get memes made about
it. Yeah, they do. I had something else I wanted to say about this, but I forget. But
all right, well, how about
go ahead?
This?
Go ahead. You can.
Eggs are a relatively small fraud. Right, so I think most people would agree, like, yeah, and I just called it fraud. It's probably usually not fraud. It's more than it is the supermarket honoring the contract.
Sometimes they're scrambled, sometimes they're fraud.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
Yeah.
Fried. that stupid commercial with the frog protection.
Oh, yeah. I think that's actually kind of funny.
I knew you would. Anyway. That's a relatively small case. Like, you know, what about a giant case like Bernie Madoff?
Yeah.
What do you do in that? How would the market solve that? Or is what Bernie Madoff did a violation of the non-aggression principle? And if there's anyone listening who doesn't know who Bernie Madoff is, I mean, I think this happened in like 2007 or 8, right? 2007, maybe?
It's been a while.
So that's a long time ago. He ran a giant Ponzi scheme.
He was in charge of Social Security?
I'm pretty sure he does have the second largest Ponzi scheme. I'm almost positive of that. First being Social Security. But, and I think he even said that. But what he did was he collected money, and he had been doing this for a long time. He was actually president of NASDAQ for a time. He was very well respected in New York on Wall Street. And he would go – the Mets were involved in investing in Bernie Madoff. There's a lot of big names. There's also a lot of regular, normal people who are investing their retirement savings through a fund that went up to Bernie Madoff. I mean, this affected a real lot of people. And he had been running this Ponzi scheme for a long time. He would collect people's monies, show them they had a return greater than what he actually got with the investments, and would pay people out on new money coming into the fund. So, you know, Rallo gives me $5. I tell him, you got 100% return. Your account's worth $10. But in reality, it was still $5. And then Rallo wants to pull out his money, and I give him the $10 that I told him he got in a return. But that money just came from other investors putting money into the fund. And so that's essentially how a Ponzi scheme works. And it grows up real big. And then when the market crashes and everyone wants to move their money out, the money's not there to move out, and it blows up.
Right.
And that's what happened with him.
And that's where the fraud is, right? It's implied that when I want to take my money out, there's going to be money there.
Yeah, well, there's fraud.
Assuming,
I get what you're saying. But, you know, the fraud was going the entire time, from the time a guy put $100 in and was told he got a 15% return, and in reality, the fund got a 5% return. He lied about what that account was worth.
Right, which would instigate people to add more money to it.
Yes.
Which is
and tell their friends.
Right.
And say, you got to invest your money with this guy. All my friends are getting 10% and he's getting 18%. Yeah. Like, you got to do this. And there was guys who had invested in him for, I think, like 40 years. I mean, at least 30. He started in the 60s. Some of them died thinking Bernie Madoff was an absolute genius investor.
Yeah.
Because they've got returns every year. When the market was down, Bernie was up.
But I guess I know this wouldn't happen, but just for the sake of argument, if you said I got 100% return on my $5 and you paid me my $5 plus you just pulled $5 out of your wallet.
My own money?
Yeah. Then it's not, you know. I mean, you're still lying.
I didn't take it from someone else, though. It was money.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's still a lie, but you got your money.
Right.
You know? I don't know. I mean, I didn't get you. Now, say I use that and I took that. Look, I got Rallo 100% return by doing my technique. I mean, I guess if I'm giving everyone the money, is there fraud? I mean, there is fraud, but is it a problem?
Probably not. I mean, yeah, it's fraud. I agree. That's absolutely fraud because
I'm lying about what I'm doing, and I'm telling you that you should give me the money because I can get you this return.
Right. And it's
I don't know why I would do that. It makes no sense.
It doesn't make any. That's why I said just for
the hypothetical. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's just. I mean, it would be fraud to say that. Hey, I bought. If I'm looking at my glass of water sitting on the desk next to me. If I said, hey, I can sell you this hand-blown glass that I made myself, and I sell it to you, and it's what you want, but I bought it from the store, you're getting the glass that you want, but not how you think it's been made. So that might not be... I would say so. I mean, you might be able to...
I mean, what if I had a painting and said, this is a Picasso, and it's not?
Right.
I mean, that's clearly fraud.
Right. But I mean, in this case, it's you see the glass. You want that glass. You just.
I tell you the painting's Picasso and I show it to you and it looks like it's a Picasso, but really I painted it.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I guess that's kind of the same thing then.
It's the same, but on a much different scale. I mean, a glass is like a couple bucks and I'm like, all right, well, it's a functional glass. I like it. I found out it wasn't his. Okay, whatever. I mean, it's still fraud, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot more value attached to a Picasso versus a McFlugel.
A Rallo.
Although, maybe not. People like Liberty mugs.
Maybe not. And, yeah.
They're better. If there's fraudulent Liberty mugs out there.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah, I know. Actually, we have a mug that says, feel free to copy. We're against IP.
Yeah. back to Bernie Madoff.
Yeah.
So I guess let's just put it this way. One, he's stealing money. He's lying and taking money. I think that's, to me, that's clearly a violation of the NAP.
Mm-hmm.
People would not invest in him if they knew what he was doing with the money. So he gave them a false story and took their money. I mean, is it much different than putting a gun to someone's head and taking their money? The person wouldn't do it without the gun or the lie.
Yeah, I mean, I think
I don't know if that's a perfect example. Probably
no,
not,
because I think it's worse to use explicit violence.
Yeah, because you could actually kill someone. You're not actually killing anyone if you just lie.
But I don't think it's
still deceptive.
Yeah, I don't think we have to convince anyone though that what Bernie did was wrong.
Right, but that was the question. Is it a violation of the NAP? And I say yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yes.
You know, I guess I don't know. I mean, certainly part of it's on the buyer, the investor, to know what they're investing in. And that's where we can get to the market.
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the things where it's, you know, for something like buying a car, I think a lot of it should be, well... whether or not this would hold,
buyer, yeah?
Yeah, whether or not it would hold up in arbitration is one thing, but that's something where it's reasonable that you can take a couple steps to, it's like when you buy a house, you hire a couple different inspectors to take a look at things because, you know, it's kind of reasonable to expect the seller's not going to disclose every single little thing, whether or not it's on purpose, or they just don't know.
I mean, and the inspector's not tearing down the walls, you know.
Right.
It's not even possible to inspect everything. We talked about this on a previous episode.
Yeah. So you agree going in, it's like, well, I'm going to hire an inspector. He's going to look at it. And if he comes up with anything, then, you know, we'll go back to the negotiation table. Yeah. And if he doesn't find anything, then, well, this is the house I'm buying.
Yep.
And if I find anything else, you know, so be it. It's not on you.
It is what it is.
So I think that's a lot easier to see as the stakes get higher, why you would want to do that. It's, you know, it's like buying a little bit of insurance.
Yep.
To spend a couple $100 to hire, an inspector when you might be spending several $100,000 on the house.
Right.
Or in my case, several $1 billion on my house.
On your house. Yes.
It's just because I bought the house in the future and inflation got so bad that, you know, a house costs billions of dollars because we have the time machine in our podcast. So,
correct.
I should have gone back in time and not and spent a couple $100.
Spend less. What's wrong with
you? Oops. It's a lot of debt I'm carrying.
But so at least anyway, what would the market do with Bernie Madoff? In your, what do you think the market would do? I guess there's no way to actually tell.
Well, they would throw him in prison like they do now, wouldn't it?
No. I don't think they would.
Yeah, I don't think so either. So this is one of the things where I think we talked about prisons before. We don't really think it's their...
Although, go ahead, because I want to bring up a point that goes to Bob Murphy's theory of prisons in a free society.
Yes, that is an excellent, excellent video that you should all watch if you haven't watched it. And if you have watched it, watch it again.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think that prisons are really that great of an idea in general, and I think you'd find very narrow cases in a free society where you would be justified to lock someone in a cage like that. I don't know if we want to get into the weeds on talking about that, or we can just throw Bob Murphy's video in the show notes page for anyone that's interested.
Yeah, I think we should just, because that would take, I mean, we could go on for a while on this. Let's just put that video up. And let's try to stick to how the market would handle Bernie Madoff.
Right.
Does that sound good or no?
Yeah, that sounds good.
I don't
good.
Mind talking about anything.
Yeah. So, yeah, the big thing, why it isn't good to send a guy like Bernie Madoff into prison. One, he's no physical... threat to anyone.
Threat to anyone, yeah. He was an old man.
Or even if he was a young man, he still wouldn't be a physical threat to anybody. Actually,
probably not.
Well, he didn't do it. His crime was not anything physical.
Right. I mean, there's no reason to think he would unless, like, I mean, it could really take this episode down a lot of tracks, but... You know, you steal $1 million from, if I stole $1 million from someone, I think I'd be looking over my back a lot. And I don't know.
And that's why you should watch Bob Murphy's video.
Exactly right. That's where I was going with that earlier.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I understand it because if someone stole my tractor, I mean, whew, man, war pain.
They'd be at least a quarter mile down the road if you caught them an hour later.
Nah, it'd be more like 12 miles down the road.
Got it all souped up?
No, that's just in third gear, standard. Not a big deal for that low boy. Okay, where were we? Harm. Yeah, so, I mean, most...
Yes, all right,
half the idea, without getting into the weeds of the Bob Murphy video... A big reason, supposedly, to put people in prison is to prevent them from hurting other people. Right. So once Bernie Madoff gets found out that they blow the lid off the Ponzi scheme, people know that he's committed fraud, lied, cheated people, and stole money from them. The jig is up, basically. And that's where I wanted to say earlier, just going back a few minutes. it's reasonable for someone to get caught in his Ponzi scheme because he was, like you said, a highly reputable guy, had been doing it for many, many years. He did have a reputation buildup, which once, he got caught, his reputation was destroyed. So it's reasonable to believe, especially if someone as high profile as Bernie Madoff, is that you're not going to have, if you don't throw him in prison and kind of just keep him out in the wild, if you will, that he's probably not going to be able to do the same thing that he just did. People are going to know about him, especially he was dealing with a lot of money. And so there's no way that the same people or the same types of people are going to go and hire him to do the same exact thing again. I don't think there's any way that would happen. Do you disagree with that?
I wouldn't invest in him.
Right.
So, although, yeah, I mean, like, okay. Yeah, go ahead. Continue. Because I was going to add something.
But... No, go ahead.
Well, what happened in this case, right, is he was investigated by the SEC several times. And the Securities and Exchange Commission is a government agency. And the reason it exists, and I believe it was FDR who created it, but the reason it exists is to protect investors from illegal, dangerous financial practices or fraud. And they require a whole lot of financial disclosure. And you have to be registered. You have to submit certain, you have to have your books audited and all this stuff. Go up through a broker dealer who's supposed to monitor you. So it doesn't work. We know that. But part of the problem is they kept signing off on him. And so the people who are investing in him see that he's still licensed. He's still good to go. Everything's on board. A lot of them didn't really have. It's almost like you can't blame them. The guy was investigated by the SEC and passed a couple times. So if you have your money in them, why would you think you shouldn't invest in them? The SEC, which is this government agency that has all these strict rules, is signing off on them.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, and that's where, you know,
the reason I say that is because we have this government agency that everyone has to use. Like, you can't get around it. There's no competing SEC. You have to use it. When they sign off on it, people think it's okay. Yeah. Whereas if we had a market for these kind of things, which, by the way, one of their competitors uncovered the fraud and reported it to the SEC. So the market did its job, essentially, and said this is not possible. He would have to have done more trades than were on the market that day in order to get this return. It's actually not possible to get these returns. And they told the SEC, and the SEC didn't find anything.
Yeah.
Without the SEC. And why? Because that's the only place you can go.
Yeah.
So this guy stayed on. His name was Markopoulos was his last name.
Markopoulos?
Yeah, basically. It's like Markopoulos or Markopoulos or something. Really smart dude. I don't want to give details on him that I don't know, but I think he was an MIT guy, like really smart guy. And he went through the returns Bernie Madoff was getting and said, this is not possible. He proved it. And he told the SEC, and the SEC either didn't listen, didn't believe him, but when they investigated Madoff, they didn't find anything. So I guess what I want to ask you is, how do you think the market would have handled that better if Markopoulos finds this fraud and brings it to light?
Well, I think there'd be a better infrastructure for handling that. I mean, look at, to bring up cars again, if you want to find out what's wrong with another brand of car, just wait for a car commercial to come up from one of the competitors, and they will probably be comparing it to the other cars in their class. And say how their car is so much better and these are the problems with the other ones. There would be certainly, especially in the financial industry like this, certainly Bernie Madoff's competitors if they're going to be checking what he's doing. Because if he's, you know, if he's making gains like that and they think it's kind of weird or suspicious, or they think it's really high, if they think it's abnormally high, they want to figure out what he's doing for one of two reasons, either to uncover that he's committing fraud or to uncover what he's doing so they can do it too.
Mm-hmm.
So if they do it, and they figure it out, then that's great for them. Now you could say, well, what if they figure it out and it's fraud and they do it too? Well, that's why we have competition. Because the bad actors are going to, you know, fraud can only take you so far, as we can see with Bernie Madoff, and it's going to blow up eventually. Cause you're not actually built on any sort of real foundation. It's going to collapse. And so unfortunately, you know, those people that chose, those gains are going to lose out a little bit, but you would expect that there's going to be enough competition out there that would manage their businesses well enough that they would have the foresight to not commit fraud that way. I mean, that's the basis for all support of the free market. That you have lower time preference actors out there. Where was I going with this? How the market dealt? Okay. So there's that aspect of it. That there would be people checking them. There's also just going to be, we talk about it all the time, free market regulation. There's going to be third parties that are going to be checking the books, doing audits. Because like we said, people want to go in and put their money into something and expect the return that they expect. And for something like this, it's pretty complex. Same with buying a house. You don't know exactly how all this stuff works, but you want an expert whose reputation on identifying issues and problems, to put his reputation on the line to, give his opinion on it. And the same thing would happen here. You would have, you know, businesses that would go in and audit and making sure that this stuff is on the up and up. And if they don't catch the bad actors, then they're going to suffer economically. If they're catching people that are committing fraud, then when they go in and give their opinion, they're going to be trusted.
And that's part of the problem with the way the system goes now is the SEC gets more money when it screws up.
Right. Right. And it's reasonable to think that these companies would carry some sort of insurance policies. That in case they do mess up, someone might try to
coverage, probably.
Right. Someone might try to get a lawsuit against them to make themselves whole.
Right.
And so that insurance company is going to make sure that these guys are auditing the companies well. And if you go in and go to, you know, Slappy's Financial Services and the Rollo auditors say, hey, we want to audit your company, make sure that you guys are doing everything on the up and up, and you say, absolutely not. Well, I mean, that sends a signal out to the market.
Yeah, what are they hiding? Why won't they show the right books?
And you may have a good reason for it, but you know,
you can make that case, but
right. And you might have to offer your stuff at a discount. Because of that, because you're making people take a higher risk on you.
Yep.
But I also, unless you had something more to say about that, I want to go into how do we make people whole? What happens after this gets blown up?
Okay. So what happens?
So currently,
Bernie Madoff has this big scheme. The market crashes. Now he has no money to pay people out.
Right. Right now, the solution is put him in prison. But the problem is, he committed the fraud, it got blown up, and we had this, you know, disaster, if you will. That caused harm to society. It was a negative in the market. People lost wealth. By throwing him in prison, you're doubling down on that destruction of wealth. Because you're removing his potential production from society. Even though that he did something bad, and he should not and probably will not be trusted in that same capacity in the future, it doesn't mean he's not capable of doing other stuff. Like you said, he was the president of NASDAQ. He was a smart guy. The fact that he ran a Ponzi scheme for that long is actually kind of impressive. He's not an idiot. So it's kind of, why would you not want him working in some capacity? Especially because, and I don't know the details of Bernie Madoff, if he was able to pay, if he had enough resources after all of this, that he was able to pay restitution. But assuming that that he's completely broke, you know, people want restitution, and there may be insurance that covers it, but the insurance company, you know, wants some money back. So if he's not able to work anymore and add value and create wealth that way, then you're not helping. You're not bringing any of that wealth back. And if he's sitting in a prison cell, he's just destroying more wealth because it takes money and resources to house him. So you sound like you're going to say something.
No, I was going. So I just looked up about the recovery of funds from the Madoff scandal. It says 1,300 people have been made whole. There was tens of thousands of claimants.
Mm-hmm.
Looks like the combined total balance of all the investments was about $64 billion. And they've paid back so far $9 billion.
Yeah, so there's
a huge loss. And they got, looks like an additional $320 million is coming soon. Pending further litigation, an additional $4 billion recovered from forfeiture actions has yet to been distributed. It looks like, I mean, they just froze all his assets and sold everything and took what they could. I mean, outside of that, what more could you do, and how could the market handle it better?
Well, it's if he's not sitting in a prison cell.
I was just going to say, one way that doesn't help is locking him in a cage.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it's nice for revenge. And maybe he's safe there, right, which is the private prison thing. I mean, if he took $1 billion from me and I had planned my retirement because I had $1 billion put up in this Madoff fund, and I was acting, assuming that I had $1 billion to stop working, and then I stopped working and there was no money, I mean, I could see someone being really angry about that.
Right.
Killing the guy doesn't help it, but, you know, most murders aren't rational, I would assume.
Yeah.
I would think. It's more emotional.
But even still, I mean, if he does seek protection for himself, no one's going to offer that to him for free.
Yep.
So he's got to pay who's ever protecting him in what we can, you know, I don't know the correct term for it, hotel prison type thing.
Yeah. By working.
Yeah. But it doesn't mean, he's probably limited on his own what he can do. So long story short, someone's probably going to have to hire or will have the opportunity to hire him. Hire Bernie Madoff.
Yeah.
That's a risk.
I mean, the reality is though, like, I don't care what system you're in. Obviously our current system didn't stop it and didn't help it.
Right.
It's really hard for one person to pay off $50 billion, no matter what they do.
Yeah.
It's probably never getting paid back.
Mm-hmm. But even if there is no, whatever this person did, there's no, nothing he has to do to make someone whole, or pay restitution, which I don't know a case where that would be, but just for the sake of argument, it still doesn't make sense to lock them in a cage and eliminate their production from society.
No, but that's where I was going next. So the guy, let's say he owes an additional $50 billion just to make people whole. Forget about lost interest, forget about inflation, all that stuff. So I guess it's not even making them whole, just to pay back the nominal number that they put in. You can't do that in really any society, or it would be really hard to. But one way you guarantee it won't be done is taking him out of society and putting him in a cage.
Right. And with that is, there has to be, for someone to hire him, they got to take a risk, because he's got this, you know, huge black mark on him. That he committed fraud before, and that he's lost a lot of trust for good reason.
Yeah. How about, just another example of a high profile case is Michael Vick.
Mm-hmm.
The Eagles hired him after he was in prison for doing dog fights, hosting dog fights.
Yeah.
I don't know all the details there, but he was really brutal with some of the dogs.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't what he did was pretty bad.
Yeah. And he lost a lot. He lost his career for a couple years, which is millions of dollars. He lost endorsements and sponsorships. He lost a lot of money over that crime. And he I think he did 2 years in prison, maybe
something like that.
When he got out, he was looking for a job, and it was very controversial when the Eagles hired him. There was some protests and people swearing they would never root for the Eagles. Although a lot of those same people are probably pretty excited with the Super Bowl.
Yeah. And that comeback against the Giants.
Yeah, that was a good one. Anyway, it was risky for the Eagles to do. It was a lot of bad PR. And I'm sure when Andy Reid, who was the coach at the time, took Michael Vick in and was interviewing him, talking to him, going through things. And Michael Vick had a questionable past even before the dog fighting came out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure Andy Reid said, "You have very unique talents. You have a lot of skills. We could use you. We want to hire you. But you got to keep your nose clean. You got to do things our way. You got to be here on time. You got to stay out of trouble. And we'll take that risk." And I don't know what what he was paid, what that first contract was. I imagine it wasn't as much as he would have been making had he never gotten in trouble.
Well, no, because it wasn't just the risk of his him going and doing bad stuff again. It was he was out of football in prison for 2 years.
Yep.
Like, guys in the NFL, any professional sport or any sport close to that level, they are constantly working on themselves to try to get better, because professional football is extremely competitive and there is always someone trying to take your job. So if they give him this contract, he ends up stinking. I mean, especially if he's got to be starting for him. I mean, they're losing games and losing. When your team's not winning, you're losing revenue and all that stuff. So, I mean, teams take winning very, very seriously for good reason. So there's just the performance risk too.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another reason why he's going to come at a discount.
Yep.
Ended up.
The PR risk is real. I mean,
oh well, yeah. There's that too.
It's saying I'm not buying your stuff. I'm not watching your games. I'm giving up my season tickets. Now there's a line of people who want season tickets and all that, but no business, no company wants a bad reputation or to anger their customers.
Well, and this is a case where it worked out pretty well, because I think a lot of those fans that say they're never going to watch, maybe some of them never watched the Eagles again, but I'm sure most of them came back around to it. And Vic also did very well for the Eagles. So it worked. Had he not,
he would have got cut.
Well, yeah, he would have gotten cut, but
he would have got cut if he didn't play well, one, or if he was getting in trouble and doing stupid things.
Right. And if he were getting in trouble and not playing well, then that would be bad for the Eagles too, because then it gets the bad PR that people double down on it.
Yep.
Because it's like, oh, see, you gave this guy a chance and we told you so. He's an idiot. You guys are terrible. Obviously I don't think that would destroy the Eagles by any stretch of the imagination, but it hurts them financially, at least in the short term, and it's not something they wanted. So bringing this back to Bernie, Madoff, someone's got to take a risk on, or not got, has to, but someone probably will take a risk on him. And the higher that risk, there is, he's got to charge less for his services. So it can be very lucrative, for a business to use his services. If he can make them a lot of money somehow for doing something pretty cheap because he is so risky, then it works out.
All right. So I just did a Google search for Vic's contract, and this is kind of what we were talking about. He did 18 months in prison. He came out, signed with the Eagles. I don't know what he was paid initially, but he had a good season that year. The 31-year-old Vic joined the Eagles in 2009 as the third-string quarterback. He started years back. It doesn't say what his original contract was, but then he signed a big deal afterwards. And this is on ESPN.com. It mentions that Vic isn't the only one who will benefit from his new contract. Vic still owes creditors in his bankruptcy case $19 million. So the fact that he's not in prison, he's able to pay off that $19 million.
Right.
Whereas if he's in a cage, he's never paying that off. The people he owes money to are never seeing it.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't even think about that part, but it's exactly what we're talking about with Madoff.
Yeah, exactly. So now he was able to get out of prison and pay off all that money he owed, and probably had some fines and stuff he had to pay too that he was able to pay back instead of sitting in prison.
Right. I think the same applies to Madoff, and I said, if it works out and he makes a lot of money, then he's able to pay people off. He's able to advance the business that took a good risk on him economically. If it doesn't work out, since he's getting paid so little, maybe there would be some PR issues they'd have to deal with, but that's part of the risk. But if, he's getting paid so little, he probably wasn't dealing, with that much responsibility, at least initially. So if they got to cut bait with him, then they cut bait and next time around, he's got to charge even less because he's a bigger risk.
Right. And like you were saying, to run a Ponzi scheme for that long, you can't be dumb. He's been in that world for a long time. He knows a lot of people. He knows how things work. I think it's reasonable to say he's not a complete idiot who doesn't know anything. He could be valuable to some company, and he could be really valuable to some company and could possibly help pay back some of that money he stole if he wasn't in jail.
Right. So, this is all well and good that we're talking about Bernie Madoff and Michael Vick, who are in their own industries two extremely talented people. But what about just an average Joe? Not even an average Joe. Someone who grew up poor went to prison for something stupid. And now he's out back on, what about that?
Yeah, so I guess, like you're saying, great, Michael Vick, he's one of the quickest athletes I've ever seen, the way he could stop and start and how fast he was and had an arm, he could throw the ball a million miles. Very unique talents. But what about an 18-year-old who goes to prison? And we're talking about fraud. I mean, Michael Vick wasn't fraud as much as, destroying animals. But nonviolent people. in the case of Bernie Madoff. So a nonviolent criminal at 18, maybe he's in jail for weed, or I don't know. Can you think of a better crime?
That's a good crime. fraud.
Let's go back to fraud. Yeah. The guy's selling stuff that's not what he says it is. He gets caught and goes to jail and comes out. And so I guess the point of this question is kind of like a devil's advocate. Fine. You're talking about high profile guys who people know all about. But a guy who doesn't have anything, who didn't lose anything, he was poor to begin with, committed fraud to get money just to get by, goes to prison and comes out. What's his incentive to not just go do it again? Because he doesn't have anything to lose.
Right.
So how do you think the market would handle that? And how do you think the current situation handles it?
Well, the current situation, they throw him in prison and call him a convict and attach this the stigma to him. And maybe that stigma is good. Committing fraud is you're stealing, so people probably should know about that. But you throw someone in prison for a while, especially someone who doesn't have much going on. Well, now you just eliminated however much time he was in prison from gaining a skill, from working somewhere, and having a chance of advancing economically. So now he's out of prison. He's back to square one. On top of that, he's got that conviction charge. And this is probably more relevant for stupid crimes that you shouldn't get in trouble for anyway, like maybe a weed violation.
Yeah.
That now he's got the stigma that he's a convict. And hopefully the culture's changing a little bit, that they employees don't really, or employers don't really care about pot charges, but I'm sure it's an issue. I mean, you don't, no one wants to walk up to trying to get a job and say, oh yeah, I just came out of prison. That doesn't reflect well. So you're just like really limiting any chance that this guy has. Not to mention that if you throw him in prison, you're putting him in like the greatest networking place for, criminals that there is. I mean,
yeah, it makes people bitter. They network. Fundraise this game.
Yeah. We'd like to think that they're being rehabilitated in there, but you know, we look at recidivism rates and they're pretty terrible. So,
and we've talked about in the past, like the Medical Information Bureau and the insurance industry, and probably having like personal liability type policies. There would likely be, and like your credit reports. I mean, everyone has a credit record, no matter how rich or poor you are. If you ever have a credit card or open a bank account, you probably have a credit record, bought a car, whatever. There's a whole lot of things. And these are ways to kind of keep track of people. So if you were to commit fraud, we'll call it your credit report in the free market, would list that on there, I'm sure, because you're a risk. You've done it in the past. And you'd probably owe back the money, so you need to pay it back. Sitting in prison really isn't going to help you pay it back at all.
Right.
Being out, and like you said, an employer could take a chance on you. Like, all right, we know this guy committed fraud. We got to keep an eye on him.
Even if they didn't know, he commits fraud somewhere and he gets fired for it. They don't charge him.
They don't charge him.
They don't convict him. So, I mean, one of the things that any business does when they're hiring someone is they ask for references. And he could say, oh, I never worked anywhere. But if you're like a 25-year-old guy who's claiming that he never worked before, I mean, that throws up red flags. So that doesn't help you out. That makes you a riskier hire. So it's even, there's that kind of, I don't want to call it fail safe, but that help. I mean, like we said, if you don't want to allow the auditors into your business to check your books, that throws up red flags. Doesn't mean that you're terrible or evil. And in the same case, if someone says, hey, I don't want you to know where I worked in the past, it throws up red flags. And for something that's just like kind of a very low paying job, I mean, you can kind of, you can take more risk on that kind of person, because if you got to fire them, assuming they don't somehow like rob you blind of, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars somehow, you know, there's not much effort or resources required to go out and look for someone else and spend the 10 minutes in the job to train him or whatever it takes. It helps.
Yeah, there'd be a lot of ways. I really do think there'd be something like I mentioned, the MIB, that whenever you apply for insurance, they send a report. So if you're a smoker and they find you a smoker, they put it on the report, so that if you commit fraud in the future by saying you were never a smoker, this report will come back and say you are.
Right.
I think a similar thing would happen. And not every business would participate, just like not every insurance company participates in the MIB, but most of them do. And if you want to take a chance on going to a company that doesn't, I'm sure you can find one. Their ratings are probably lower. Their premiums might actually be better. I don't know. But that's up to you to decide. So stuff like this already happens in the market.
Right.
And if you just got government out of the way, which doesn't compete, so it doesn't have to maintain a reputation at all. And in fact, their incentive is to screw up so they get more money. It's just not a good system. So if you did it in a market where there is competition, where people want to make sure they're hiring good people and bad people want bad people in quotation marks, want an opportunity to rehabilitate themselves and their reputation, you can't do it in a cage, and you lose time and you lose skills. And it's, you know, two working years. If you do 2 years in prison, two working years is a lot of money. That could have been paid back, and you're just sitting there being unproductive.
Mm-hmm.
I think a much better system would be that if something was done fraudulently, it's reported somewhere, possibly. But like you said, if not, there's still going to be references. And if you got fired for stealing stuff from your company or something, your business will, your former employer will tell the potential employer about that. Most likely if they think you're not a good guy. And if the company that's hiring you doesn't check references, well, that's up to the company.
Right. And, maybe they're poorly, if they're doing that and, you know, flying blind like that, maybe they're poorly managed and they should be, you know, demoted economically for that.
Probably, or they just have very low skilled positions and they can easily refill them in, and they don't, you know, you're working with a guy who's not around expensive stuff. You know, I don't know. There could be a lot of reasons why they do certain things.
But yeah, but the point is the market will find a way to sort that
exactly,
out.
Exactly, exactly. And that job that I was just describing will probably be a very low paying job. Mm-hmm. And if that's where you have to go to rehabilitate yourself, you might have to do that for 2 years. But even those, or two or whatever number of years, those 2 years, you're more productive doing that job than you are sitting in a cage.
Right. And that's the other thing, is that it allows you to rebuild your reputation. Because the every minute that goes by that you're, you know, turned around and doing a good job is kind of more proof that you're not going to revert back to what you did before.
Like a lot of people who are in their 30s can say, yeah, I was really dumb when I was 16. I did some stupid things. I'm not like that anymore.
Right.
Well, it may have taken, you know, 5-10 years doing the right thing all the time to rehabilitate that reputation. Mm-hmm. But they were able to do it. And had they been in a cage doing nothing, it's really hard to rehabilitate.
Absolutely.
So you got anything else to add? We've been going on for a while.
Yeah, no, I'm good. Did you have a free market success story?
No.
Okay. I forgot to talk about before, but yeah. I thought of something.
I could have talked about the cigar event, but it's not really it's a success to me, but, cause I got lots of cigars for not a lot of money.
Nice.
But, go ahead.
No, I was talking to a coworker today and he ordered something. We're talking about the other day, part of my heritage is Polish. And we're talking about kind of
just why we talk slow here.
Yeah. the Polish Eagle, and kind of how it's a, you know, cool heritage thing. And he's saying that he bought, an article of clothing, I think on Friday or something. And it was from Poland. It had to be imported, into the U.S. And he said, man, I checked online today and saw like the tracking and it's going to be delivered tonight. When I get home, the package is going to be delivered. And he's like, that's amazing to me that, you know, you could see it's like, man, it went from Poland to Germany, Germany to New York. And then from New York, it's already like on a truck or wherever it came to the U.S. at.
How long did this take?
It was like Thursday or Friday. He put the order in. Nice. And I think he's getting it tonight.
Yeah.
That's amazing that we've reached the point of, this shipping. Maturity that, you know, it's amazing. And I think we talked about how Amazon can deliver like almost everything in 2 days. And now it's down to 1 day and they're doing shipping for free. But can you imagine like 5 years ago trying to get something from Poland? It would take a while and it would probably be pretty expensive. But nowadays there's so much commerce around the world, so much stuff that there's an incentive to just, some of these shipping companies, they just have flight after flight
going right, from with point A to point B and back and forth.
Right.
It's all about service. Mm-hmm. Buy from us. We can get it to you quicker than the other guy.
Yep.
No one's forcing them. There's no laws created that say you must deliver a package overnight.
Yeah.
These companies are just doing it.
Yeah. I mean, if Amazon didn't have that 2-day free shipping selling point, I don't think they'd have the command in the market that they do now.
No, and other companies are starting to catch up because they see what that did and how profitable it is, which pulls more people into the market. So, like, for example, I see commercials for Walmart who do overnight shipping or 2-day shipping or something. They have some kind of, I don't know what the details of the program are, but they advertise it on TV all the time that you can get your shipping from Walmart.
Yep.
They weren't doing that before Amazon was.
Yep. And like I said before, with the check-in for fraud and everything, where they check and see if they can blow people up. By discovering something that they're doing bad. But in this case, obviously, if Amazon's delivering packages in 2 days, they're doing it. So other companies are going to want to see what they're doing. It's the same sort of principle.
Yeah, it's the same thing with anything in the market. If someone's selling, any new kind of product and it's really profitable, people are going to go into that. Same if a business is doing something like shipping. Wow, that's really profitable for them to do that. We got to do that.
Yep. Profits are great signals.
Yes.
So, okay. Show notes page again, mcflugel.com/110. We will throw up a link to that Bob Murphy talk, because it is really, really good. And it helped, calibrate my thinking a couple years ago when I first saw it. So I highly recommend that. Also check out Liberty Mugs. Get your discount by signing up to the mcflugel.com newsletter. And also subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, all those good things. Make sure you share it and give us some feedback on iTunes and Stitcher and any other place that allows for that. And check out some of our friends out there. We got Mance Rader, Free Man Beyond the Wall, the Friends Against Government podcast, Dino Files, and the Peaceful Treason podcast. So with that, we'll catch you next week or next year or last year.
Peace.